Often in the theatre, in the full view of the people, Theodora would throw off her clothes and stand naked in their midst, having only a pair of knickers over her private parts and her groin, not because she was ashamed to expose these also to the public, but because no one is allowed to appear there absolutely naked. Underwear is compulsory. And with this costume, she would spread herself out and lie on her back on the floor. Certain menials on whom this task had been imposed would then sprinkle barley grains over her private parts, and geese trained for the purpose used to pick them off with their beaks one by one and swallow them. Theodora, far from blushing when she stood up again, actually seemed to be proud of this performance, for she was not only shameless herself, but did more than anyone else to encourage shamelessness. And many times she threw off her clothes and stood in the middle of the actors on the stage, leaning over backwards or pushing out her rear to invite both those who had already enjoyed her and those who had not been intimate as yet, parading her own special brand of gymnastics. With such lasciviousness did she misuse her own body that she appeared to have her privates not like other women in the place intended by nature, but in her face. That, Dominic, was a Procopius, a historian from Palestine in the 6th century, writing about indisputably the most famous of all the empresses of Constantinople, Theodora, and it is one of the most notorious, scabrous, shocking passages in the whole of ancient literature.
Yes, it is, Tom. Her own special brand of gymnastics. That's a phrase that I think a lot of our listeners will take with them from this podcast.
Yes. And so the huge question that hangs over that is, how is it that the most famous empress of Constantinople could have such filth? I think you can call it filth.
I think you can. Sexist filth indeed, Tom.
Written about her. Is it true? And what is the context for this extraordinary passage?
Well, Tom, let us remember one thing. The woman we're talking about here is a saint. It's literally a saint.
Yes. So that is a further dimension.
A further complication. So Theodora and her husband Justinian are probably the two most famous, most celebrated individuals associated with what we now think of as the Byzantine Empire. Although, Tom, that's not a label that they ever used of themselves.
No, they're the Romans. They're Roman.
They were the Romans. So this is the glamour, the decadence, the so-called decadence, the exoticism to Western observers of the Eastern Roman Empire, of the successor, what is it, a successor state? We can talk about that in the podcast. Of this empire that from, let's say, what would you say, Tom, the 4th century to the 15th century dominates the Eastern Mediterranean. It's the world of icons, of mosaics, of magnificent churches, of Constantinople, the greatest city on earth. The empire that is seen by some historians today as the sort of the shield of Europe against Islam. But it's actually not as well known, I think, in the West as it should be. Would you agree with that, Tom?
Well, this is a topic both of us have really wanted to do. So I've written a book about this, In the Shadow of the Sword, just get my plug in. And
good plug.
You are wearing a T-shirt with the emblem of Byzantium on the front.
I am, by coincidence.
The two-headed eagle.
I'm not wearing it deliberately for this podcast. Because I've always been an aficionado of this, because I studied it at university. And funnily enough, the reason I studied it at university was the first thing I did when I went to Oxford. And it was because it seemed to me, you know, I was 18 and it seemed so exotic and glamorous compared with the English Civil War, which I've been doing for A-level. And I think to most people, Byzantium still has that allure, doesn't it? It's the sort of
golden horn.
Yes.
The very language. So John the Lydian, another historian, Byzantine historian, described Constantinople as the all golden city. And it's that idea of gold, isn't it? And
it's that idea. I mean, some people will be familiar with this because we did a podcast about the Vikings in the East. And the idea of the Vikings sailing down all these rivers and into the Black Sea. And at the end, they see this golden city that is basically the template for Asgard. This world of a harbor full of ships, massive city walls, the churches, the dome of the Hagia Sophia, the Church of the Holy Wisdom, like nothing they had ever seen on earth.
Caesar's golden city. Yeah, I mean, it just has an incredible resonance and romance. So I think I think that probably the best way to start on this story, and we'll come, I think we should come to the question of how accurate that portrayal of Theodora's youth may have been. And also we should say that Procopius is equally as rude about Justinian.
He is indeed. We shall become to Justinian's face later in the podcast.
So he's not just being sexist when he's rude. I mean, he's rude about everybody.
Yeah.
But I think to begin with, it would make sense, wouldn't it, to look at Constantinople, the city that is the stage for both these extraordinary figures.
Yes.
And you talked about how, you know, this is described as the capital of the Byzantine Empire, but you also then immediately said, well, yes, but it's the Roman Empire as well. So we should probably just kind of focus in on the degree to which what we call the Byzantine Empire is a break from the Roman Empire and not. And I would say it isn't really.
Yeah, I agree with you completely.
Because the key thing about Constantinople is it is strategically, it's incredibly defensible. So it's a kind of promontory sticking out from Thrace, sticking out from the kind of the easternmost section of Europe. That means that if you build walls around it, it's very easy to defend. But it's also, it controls what already by the second century are the two key areas for Roman strategists, namely the Danube and the frontier with the Syrian frontier. So I'm writing about Hadrian at the moment. And when he becomes emperor, he's facing war both on the Syrian frontier and on the Danube. And so the first winter that he spends as emperor, he spends probably in Byzantium, which is the original Greek name of the city. So even then you can see that, you know, the fact that this is a position from which you can control these kind of two frontiers makes it absolutely key. And really the question is why it wasn't bigger. And I think one of the reasons why it wasn't bigger and more strategic before it kind of gets promoted to become the second Rome, the new Rome, is the lack of water. It's as basic as that.
Yeah. But once you sort that out, so once you've got aqueducts, these tremendous aqueducts bringing water to the city. I mean, as you say, I think the position is, so you can go to the Bosphorus, obviously, most people will have heard of the Bosphorus, the waterway, the strait that divides Europe from Asia. You've got the Sea of Marmara, and once you go down through that, you're into the Aegean. So the strategic location is perfect. And I think, if you think about the Roman Empire, so obviously Rome, the city of Rome, still has this tremendous sort of prestige, but all the action has been taking place on the frontiers for the Romans by the, what are we talking about, the 4th century, I suppose. Yeah. And they've been moving around, haven't they, the emperors? They've spent time in Milan, they've moved, they're military emperors who need to be close to the frontiers to deal with the action on the frontiers, which is the kind of, in inverted commas, barbarian incursions. And Constantinople makes sense, as you say, because actually we often, because we're so Western orientated, we forget that for the Romans, the big rival was always the same, wasn't it? It was Persia.
Yeah.
And that frontier in Mesopotamia is, of all the frontiers, I suppose that's the high value one, the prestigious, because a victory against the Persians is more valuable in PR terms than a victory against Goths or something.
Because back in Hadrian's day, he's facing the Parthians, who are a kind of shadowy threat compared to the Persian, the Sasanian Empire that emerges in the 3rd century and which kind of endures throughout this period. And effectively, it's a rival superpower, which the Romans hadn't previously had to face.
Yeah.
And so that, I think, is really the key to why the city of Byzantium in the early 4th century becomes the city of Constantinople. Constantine has defeated all his rivals for the rule of the empire. He's the sole ruler. And just as he is the sole ruler on earth, so he has enshrined as the prevailing deity over the Roman Empire, the Christian God who rules alone over the universe, the cosmos. And he wants a new capital. And I think that that is what makes Constantinople different to, say, Milan or Trier or any of these other kind of places that have been temporary capitals, is that Constantine deliberately sets out to make it a second Rome, a new Rome.
But what's so interesting about Constantinople, though, isn't it, Thomas, that it is the duality. So it's both a new Rome, and that at first they have lots of statues of Romans, don't they? They do it in that kind of classical style. But at the same time, it quickly becomes a sort of rival center of Christendom to Rome itself, doesn't it? And that's really important because it gives it a different character from Rome, which I suppose to some people might seem tainted by the paganism of the past.
To a degree, but I think that when Constantine founds Constantinople, and right the way up to the time of Justinian in the early 6th century, the patterns that Constantinople has inherited from Rome are really important. So you have the figure of the emperor, and his palace, and initially Constantine kind of, it's modeled on a praetorium, so a kind of military headquarters, but it rapidly becomes much, much larger than that, this kind of great sprawling edifice. Then you have a Senate, and then you have the masses of the people. And just as in Rome, the emperor meets the people in the Circus Maximus, which is the great chariot racing space. So in Constantinople, you have this space, the Hippodrome, where chariots race. And so that idea of a kind of tripartite division of the emperor, the Senate, the people is something that Constantinople inherits. And I think that there's a kind of people in Constantinople feel the kind of anxiety of parvenus in the early years, which is why Constantine basically, I mean, he does a Lord Elgin. He just goes around, you know, the great cities of Greece, stripping them of all their treasures and dumping them in Constantinople. So there's this great bath complex there, the Baths of Zippus, which are absolutely adorned with, you know, it's kind of like the British Museum. It's absolutely stuffed full of loot. So I think that that matters. And they, and topographers kind of, you know, they rustle up seven hills in Constantinople.
I'm just looking at a map now with these seven hills that, by a remarkable coincidence, same number as in Rome.
Yeah. And Rome had always been the city that grain comes from Egypt and North Africa. And Constantinople has that kind of, grain as well. So you have all these kind of elements that are very, very deliberately modeled on Rome.
I mean, I'm just looking at a map of Constantinople in the 6th century. Now, you can download them from the internet. And to just pick up on what you were saying, I mean, the Hippodrome is right by the palace complex. It actually reminds me in some ways, Tom, of something we did talked about in a previous podcast of Ptolemaic Alexandria, of a city that is both a city of great learning and sort of a city of scholarship and sort of seriousness and stuff. And yet there's always that mob, you know, there's that sort of, and the fact that the palace and the Hippodrome are so close together. So to give people who don't know much about this a sort of sense of it, this is Istanbul, it's modern Istanbul. It's the a part of Istanbul called Fatih. So it's on the European side, it's on the southern side of the harbor known as the Golden Horn. And I mean, Constantinople grows so quickly, doesn't it, Tom? So by the time we're talking about, it's probably got, what, half a million people?
Yeah, about half a million.
Probably the biggest city in the world, I think. I mean, Chinese historians might dispute that, but I think it's, most people would say it's probably the single biggest city in the world.
The measure of that is that Constantine has built walls and they've rapidly kind of grown out of them. So in the 5th century, an emperor called Theodosius II builds another vastly imposing sequence of walls that are further out. And so essentially the stretch of land between Constantine's walls and Theodosius's walls are where cisterns can be built to store water. There are monasteries, there are kind of market gardens.
They're the walls that you see today, by the way, the Theodosius, they're still standing. I mean, they're incredible.
And they are vast. And I think there's a case for saying that they are probably the best infrastructure investment of all time, because they enable Constantinople to withstand any number of sieges. And they're built with the, you know, all the resources that Rome then had, and a hugely beneficial investment.
Well, I think that's a really important point, Tom, because the portrait, ever since Edward Gibbon wrote his Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, the image we've had of this world, in English-speaking countries, has been one of a sort of sad decline from the virtues of the Roman heyday and a sort of decadence. So in other words, you'll have a sort of a book on the Roman Empire in which they'll cover 500 years in 400 pages and then another 1,000 years in 10 pages. Oh, this was a sad epilogue, and it's all very decadent and orgiastic. And of course, the end was coming. You know, the writing was on the wall, basically, when they founded Constantinople. But obviously, that's a ludicrous way of looking at it. I mean, this is a city that endures for the best part of 1,000 years until it's taken by the Fourth Crusade. Is it the Fourth Crusade? It is the Fourth Crusade, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then later on, the Ottomans. I mean, this is a very, very rich, sophisticated, I mean, as we said, the biggest city on earth, incredibly multicultural, cosmopolitan. You would have heard in the marketplaces every imaginable language. I mean, obviously, it's a very Christian city, but there must have been visitors from every part of the known world. You could buy anything you wanted. It's a city of pleasure. It's got these kind of seething crowds in the Hippodrome. I mean, an incredibly intoxicating place.
And I think also part of the reason why Gibbon and why, you know, the word Byzantine has become such a kind of pejorative is because there's a feeling that the less Roman it becomes, the more it goes into decline.
Yeah.
But I don't think, I mean, that's I don't think that's true at all. I mean, the elements of the Roman remain, and I think they are very radically recalibrated under Justinian in paradoxical ways. And it in many ways, Justinian's reign is both an attempt to restore the Roman Empire and a complete recalibration of it.
Yeah.
And it does end up becoming a Greek empire, a Christian empire. The kind of the Roman and the pagan elements tend to, you know, fade away. But the kind of the richness of that means that it is an astonishingly sophisticated and fascinating civilization. And Justinian and Theodora play key roles.
Just before we get on to Justinian and Theodora, just one last thing about the geopolitics of it. Because obviously the Roman Empire has changed since it's what we commonly think of as its heyday. But the bits that have been, as it were, lost, I mean, they are the bits you would actually, if you had to lose bits.
Well, including Rome.
They are the bits you would choose to lose because they're poorer. So you would choose to lose Britain. And if you had to, you would get rid of Gaul. Okay, fine. You'd prefer to keep Spain, but if you have to lose it, you do. Because the bits that are left are not some sort of decadent leftover. They are the richest, most productive. You know, they're the most interesting, most potent bits, aren't they? So it's basically the half that Mark Antony had when Octavian divided up the empire. It's exactly that half.
It is, and that reflects the fact that there are kind of geographical factors in the split between the west and the eastern halves. And the western half that gets conquered by the barbarians, as the Romans would call them, you know, they drift away because of the fact you have the Alps, you have the Adriatic. You know, these are kind of natural barriers and borders. But having said that, you know, if you had to give up anything, you'd give up the western half, there are two obvious areas that people in Constantinople are particularly keen to get back. One is North Africa, which is incredibly rich as a supplier of grain. So that really matters. And the other, of course, is Italy, because Italy has the original Rome.
Just to fill people in, Tom, to the Vandals in North Africa. So that's about, when we say North Africa, we're talking about the coasts of Algeria, Libya, Tunisia. And then Italy has fallen to the Goths, hasn't it?
Yeah, the Ostrogoths. And this matters not just because the loss of the original Rome is a humiliation, but also because in a Christian world, the Pope, the Bishop of Rome, remains the senior bishop, even though the Patriarch, the Bishop of Constantinople, has been kind of promoted over the heads of the bishops of Antioch and Jerusalem and Alexandria. Yeah. So the links with Rome are still very important, and this is something that does kind of haunt people in Constantinople, the sense that they've lost a kind of vital part of what it is to be Roman.
So let's talk about the characters, our principles. So let's start with, since we've framed this through Theodora, I should say, Tom, we've been very remiss, haven't we, in not pointing out to our listeners, some of whom I think are new because we've accumulated new listeners in recent days, that Theodora is actually the reigning champion of historical Love Island.
She is, yes. Yes, she absolutely is.
Which was our much-fated show, our much-fated historical reality show that we did, in which she triumphed along with former Prime Minister, three-time Prime Minister.
In the 30s.
In the 1920s and 30s, Stanley Baldwin. They made a lovely couple.
Improbable.
Improbable, but very successful, much liked by the fans.
Yes.
And if you want to find out more about that, you should go to our Historical Love Island episode.
But Dominic, of course, also, Theodora's husband, Justinian, of course, was the theme of our previous episode that we did with Carl Harper on the collapse of the Roman Empire and the impact that pathogens had on it. And
yes.
In that episode, when we talked about the Justinianic plague, Justinian is the Justinian as in the Justinianic plague.
Exactly. And he's a great character too, actually, Tom. He is a tremendously impressive character. Or is he, as we will discuss. Exactly.
Yes.
So should we start with Theodora? So Theodora, she is born about, we don't know exactly, about 500, I think that's fair to say, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah, roughly that, yeah.
And we don't know, well, because she's from a lowly background, we're not entirely sure, I think, of her sort of, as it were, her ethnic ancestry. So some people said she was from Cyprus, some people said she was from Syria, but we do know that she grew up in the city, in Constantinople, because her father, I believe, was a bear keeper.
He was, yeah. So, and he's a bear keeper for one of the two main rival teams in the Hippodrome.
Yeah.
So this is what, Manchester City, Manchester United.
Yeah, but it's bigger than that, isn't it? It's much bigger than that.
Liverpool, Everton.
The Greens and the Blues.
The Greens and the Blues. And they hate each other. The supporters hate each other.
But they're not just... So people often... I mean, it's one thing that people who don't know much about Constantinople know about Constantinople is they have these mad circus sort of chariot racing factions and teams. But they're more than sports teams, aren't they? They're kind of militias. They're almost... Yeah. They're kind of clubs. They're...
Yeah, and they take sides in kind of theological arguments.
Yeah.
Which I think is something that we very much miss from contemporary sport.
Yeah, you don't get that with fans of West Bromwich Albion, do you? they are...
Well, they're potential paramilitaries.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, obviously, if you've got huge gangs of ultras, I mean, that's the kind of standing temptation, aren't they?
Yeah.
Well, that's... I mean, you kind of get that slightly in Russia, don't you, today?
You get in Russia, you got it in Yugoslavia in the 1990s, fans of Dinamo Zagreb or Red Star Belgrade. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's not unknown at all.
I mean, to a degree, perhaps just, you know, a little bit in Glasgow.
Celtic Rangers. Yeah,
I mean, a slight kind of, you know, there's because there you have a kind of sectarian divide. People taking positions. I mean, you know, they're not arguing about transubstantiation or anything, but, you know, there's a slight kind of theological edge there. So that's maybe a kind of very faint, distorted parallel.
So anyway, the Greens have their own bear. I mean, they obviously must put on shows.
Well, they both have bears.
Yes. I mean, they must have multiple animals, I assume. And Theodore's father, who I think is called Acacius, he is a bear keeper, isn't he? And we don't know her mother's name. Her mother probably, again, a performer, an acrobat, a dancer. What do you think, Tom?
I think if you kind of imagine the Super Bowl crossed with a kind of very high-class strip club, you probably have some idea of what's going on in the kind of the intervals between the races.
Yeah.
Because after each race, invariably people will crash, you know, bits of... body will have to be removed from the sand, will have to be swept up, everything will have to be prepared for that. And often you're having kind of 20 or so races in a day. So they need entertainment because you've got what, kind of 50,000 people? Because this is a vast hippodrome. The original one that was built back in the early 3rd century wasn't large enough. So it kind of sticks off the hill on which it's been built and is held up on kind of great concrete props. So it's an extraordinary structure, and it has this great kind of spine running down the middle that's decorated with an obelisk and statues. And actually, the famous trophy that the Greeks set up in Delphi after the defeat of the Persians back in the 5th century BC, and which is still there. So an extraordinary place. And this is what Theodora, her two sisters, her mother, her father, they are making their living from this. So they're kind of born into the entertainments that are laid on in between the races.
Well, she appears as a child, doesn't she? She appears in burlesques and comedies. Yeah. And so, you know, it's like being born into a circus family, but sort of turned up to 1,000. But her father dies, doesn't he, when she's quite young?
Yeah.
And her mother marries again, I think.
So they're with the Greens.
Yeah. And her mother goes to see the Greens and says, I've married again. And she takes her children with her, I think, Theodore among them. She goes to see the Greens and she said, the bosses of the Greens, she says, I've married again. That bear keeper job, can my new husband have the bear keeper job? And the Greens say, no, you know, we've given it to someone else. And she is so outraged that the whole family switch allegiances.
Well, she does it in public. So she brings the children, trying to tug the heartstrings of the crowd, before where the you know, the leaders of the Greens are, and they turn her down publicly. And so the leaders of the Blues then say, oh, we'll give you the job.
Yeah.
So they switch. And this is quite important for the story because Justinian, before he becomes emperor, is a big partisan of the Blues.
So he is, yes.
That means that from this point on, Theodora and Justinian are supporting the same team.
And so Theodora has to make her way in the world. Her mother, you know, they've got this link with the Blues now, but she has to make her own way as a kind of performer. And I guess at this point, you'd have to say that job of being a dancer, an acrobat, a comedian, that in the world of Constantinople in the early 6th century, that blurs quite imperceptibly into the world, as you said, of being a stripper or indeed of being a courtesan. Because that effectively, I guess, is what she probably was when she was in her late teens, maybe.
So this is something that Constantinople, again, has inherited from Rome, who viewed actors as the lowest of the low. so ranked alongside prostitutes. And as you say, the kind of the boundary between prostitute and actress was often very narrow. And so Constantinople has inherited that prejudice, but it's now also a Christian city in which acting, burlesques, and prostitution are all condemned for Christian reasons.
Right.
So there's lots of reasons why Theodora might get, you know, public condemnations. And why, in due course, she betters herself by essentially turning her back on the theatre and on the hippodrome, because she gets a patron, doesn't she?
Yeah. Oh, the civil servant guy
who goes off to govern Libya.
Yeah, Hecabalus.
And he's a bit of a brute, so he beats her.
Yeah.
And so she runs away, leaves him, and goes to Alexandria, where she seems to have had a kind of religious experience. So
everybody's Christian, and they take it incredibly seriously. I mean,
well, not everyone is Christian.
Well, who's not Christian?
Well, we'll come to this, but say there are Platonists in Athens, say, still,
okay,
at this point.
Not many people.
But they are still very much a part of the fabric of it.
But the details of Christian doctrine are a matter of enormous political and cultural significance, and arguments about those details. When she ends up, she's been in Constantinople, she goes to Alexandria, she is going to a part of the empire that many people in the capital regard as heretical, don't they? Because the people in Alexandria, Alexandria is a hotbed of something called Monophysitism.
Should we, at this point,
take a break?
Before everyone runs for terror, should we have a break? And then when we come back, I think we should roll up our sleeves and we won't go into it in huge detail, but we just need to explain what the point of issue is.
It's very exciting, Tom.
It is exciting.
I think people will, it's a cliffhanger. more.
I know, but I've become so kind of, you know, sensitive to you complaining when we talk about Christianity that...
Do you know, I should tell the listeners this. This is the only time in recorded history where when we were discussing this episode, I said to Tom, come on, get stuck into it, do it properly. And he's a little bit nervous. So
I'm
come back
nervous,
after the break to see Tom talking about the nature of Christ. See you in a minute. Bye-bye. Welcome back to The Rest is History. Now, you may remember that the first half of this episode began with an extraordinary reading from Tom Holland about the special brand of gymnastics performed by the Empress Theodora when she was a girl. Now, Tom will be producing his own special brand of gymnastics, as he is going to explain the nature of the Monophysite heresy, a very exciting subject. It's actually a bloodstained subject. So it's much more interesting than skeptics might think. So, Tom, what on earth is going on?
So probably one of the things that people know about Byzantium, and it's been a kind of subject of mockery again ever since the time of Edward Gibbon, is that the empire and the church is endlessly debating the nature of Christ. So this happens right from the beginning. So under Constantine, there are debates about whether the Son, Jesus, you know, whether Christ is... a part of God, whether the Son is kind of co-eternal with the Father, all this kind of stuff. And that gets resolved. And they decide basically that, yes, the Father, Son, and Spirit are all kind of part of a whole.
This is very precise.
But by the 5th century, there's a new controversy. And that is basically, so theologians have decided that Christ, the figure of Jesus, is both human and divine. So he has two natures. He has his divine nature and he has his human nature. And the question then is, what is the relationship of these two natures?
Yeah.
So basically, you can boil it down to thinking of it like this. So is it like gin and tonic? So you have your gin, let's say that's the divine, and you have your tonic, that's the human, and you mix them up in a glass and they become indivisible.
Yeah.
Or are they like olive oil and water?
They don't mix.
And they don't mix.
No.
And so this becomes the kind of the great, great dividing line.
I mean, we could sort of get bogged down in all this, couldn't we, in the details of it. But I suppose the essence of it is that, am I right in thinking there was an ecumenical council? That's a big meeting of church bigwigs in 451.
600 bishops.
In Chalcedon, which is now... But again, part of Istanbul, but on the Asian side.
Yeah.
And they basically hammered out what they thought was the formula, and then some people didn't like it.
Yeah, so the formulation that they arrive at Chalcedon, which is still upheld by pretty much so the Orthodox, the Catholics, Protestants, I mean, they all uphold it, is that you have one and the same Son, our Lord Jesus Christ, the same perfect in Godhead and also perfect in manhood, truly God and truly man. So in other words, the oil and the water, they're both equally important. They haven't mixed to create what in Greek is monophysis, a sole nature.
I told you it would be Tom's special brand of gymnastics, and it is.
But after Chalcedon, there are still people who are very keen on the idea that this single nature is what Christ is all about. So they come to be called monophysites.
So as far as I can tell from my own reading of this, this is not just a sort of doctrinal theological issue. It's also an issue about power and regions and so
everything
on.
Everything is. Yeah.
So, yeah, of course. So you've got, as it were, the inverted commas Orthodox view, which is the view held in Constantinople, and it's associated, I suppose, with the state, with the emperor, and with a sort of central authority. And then you have this heresy, as it's called, which is Monophysitism, and that's stronger in places like Alexandria and bits of Syria and so on. So in other words, in Egypt and North Africa, in places that maybe would resist very strong central control and being bossed around by the capital. Yeah. So it's a capital versus provincial thing to some extent, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you know, you mentioned Alexandria, which is the second city of the empire. It always has been ever since the defeat of Cleopatra. It's, like Constantinople, a very turbulent city, very proud of its dignity and status. And in a way, the kind of the tensions between Chalcedonian and Monophysite Christians become a way for Alexandria to kind of proclaim its distinctiveness.
Yeah.
And so when Theodora turns up there, she comes under the wing of the patriarch Timothy, and she becomes a very devout Monophysite. Rather in the manner, and I think that this is kind of an important part of her appeal to Christians in the long run. Rather like the way that Mary Magdalene is coming to be portrayed as a kind of repentant prostitute.
Yeah.
Even if there is nothing in the Gospels themselves that sustains that, the idea that someone who has turned to Christ, whose background perhaps is not all it could have been, in a way is a kind of greater catch.
Yeah, of course, but that's part of that's part of Theodora's enduring appeal. I mean, in a way, you could argue, Tom, that's one of the reasons we're doing this podcast at all, is because that archetype of the sort of
the repentant whore,
the woman who was once terribly licentious but has now repented and become incredibly good and incredibly impressive. I mean, that runs through Western culture, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So she must have returned. We don't know exactly when. I think to Constantinople, at the end of her teens or in her very early 20s.
Yeah,
and there at some point that we don't know. Again, she's obviously still a great catch. I mean, she's still young, and she meets an older man who is a real rising star, whose name is, well, his original name is Flavius Petrus Sabbatius, but now he calls himself Justinian.
Because he's been adopted by a guy called Justin, who just happens to be the emperor.
Just happens to be the emperor, exactly. So the empire, when Theodora was born, the emperor was a man called Anastasius.
Yes.
Who had an interesting distinction. His eyes were different colours.
Yes. One was black and one was blue, wasn't
it? Yeah. I remember a black eye.
And he was also very bald.
Very bald. I mean, can he be very bald?
I think very bald because he gets praised by poets who are looking to flatter him.
Right. What about his baldness?
Yes, because they hail him. They say of his forehead that it gleams like silver.
So he's a balder man than Stanley Tucci, who's very bald, but he's even balder.
But I think his forehead has this kind of this
tremendous glow.
This glow, and he is a bureaucrat. He's a civil servant who's kind of stepped up because there's a gap. There's a vacancy. And the fact that he can be praised for having a gleaming forehead, it's not a reflection not just on his baldness, but also the fact that he's an absolute whiz at accountancy. And the treasury has been a bit depleted. Anastasius, his great contribution, rather than going out and kind of leading campaigns, he stays in the palace, he crunches numbers, he counts beans, and he sets the Roman currency, the Byzantine currency, on a tremendously strong new footing. So the solidus, as it's called, it is solid. It's a massively strong currency made of gold. And basically, this will be the kind of the underpinning for Byzantine financial strength for centuries and centuries to come.
An immensely bald emperor with a very, very solid solidus is what you're, saying. But anyway, that I think it's good to talk about Anastasius, because that gives the lie to any lingering ideas that this is a sort of decadent, shambolic, incompetent, excessively corrupt, all of these kinds of sort of things that have been thrown at the Eastern Roman Empire. This is a confident, relatively stable state, isn't it? Dominating the Eastern Mediterranean.
So basically, it's run by militarized accountants.
Yes.
Of whom Anastasius is the absolute exemplar. So kind of civil servants who are working in the Great Palace are kind of recruited into a non-existent legion. And they have swagger sticks, they wear gold, they wear kind of purple, they wear tremendous belts, which, you know, these military belts that descend from the legionary tradition that become the emblem of the bureaucrat. And the palace, which had been built by Constantine on quite a kind of austere basis, by this point, it's a kind of cross between Gormenghast and the office. It's it's huge, kind of great warren of passageways, many different floors, or, you know, they even have a riding school in the middle of it.
I mean, this is basically like 10 Downing Street, Tom. I mean,
But on a much, much larger scale.
Yeah.
But you still have this kind of, it's this kind of weird fusion of, you know, the legionary inheritance, but they're all accountants. So Anastasius is absolutely the exemplar of that. But of course, Anastasius needs to have guards. You need to have bodyguards, because as the emperor, of course you do. So they are also a feature of it. And bodyguards usually are recruited from, you know, the more barbarous reaches of the empire, the Balkans traditionally. Mm-hmm. And so this guy arrives as a refugee from a barbarian invasion from what is now Skopje. So Skupi, it's called. And this is Justin. I think his original name was Istok.
Yes, he's of peasant stock, isn't he? Possibly sort of Thracian ethnicity, we don't know. Justin is not literate. So he has a stencil when he becomes, he has to do everything with a special sort of stencil. Anyway, we're jumping ahead. He's the commander of the guard, isn't he?
Yeah.
And basically, Anastasius has been emperor, from the end of the fifth century, and then he dies in 518, in the summer of 518. He's got no heir.
And he doesn't have a son. Well, he does. I mean, potentially he has three nephews. Well,
there's a very shambolic scene, isn't there, with his nephews? You know about the stuff with the couches?
Remind me.
So supposedly, I mean, this is one of these stories in the rest of his history in which we specialize that's almost certainly untrue. He decided that God would decide who would succeed him. So he wrote a note with the word regnum, and he put it under the cushions of one of the couches, and he decided that which of the nephews sat on this couch would succeed him, because God would have chosen him. And they all came in, but they were great pals, all the nephews. They all sat on the same couch. So it didn't work. Now, the other story is that he then said, that was a terrible disaster. I shall pray to God. And he prays overnight, and God gives him this vision and says, the man who comes into your bedchamber first tomorrow will be your heir. I mean, that's obviously a terrible way of deciding. And the man who comes in as the commander of the guard, who is this Balkan peasant.
Justin.
Called Justin. But there's another story, isn't it, that Justin basically bribes his way.
Well, so when Anastasius dies, one of these three nephews, who's a very able man called Hypatius, is in command of the Roman forces on the eastern frontier against Persia. So that's a key military command. You know, he's linked to the emperor, and he has command of the armies, but he doesn't want it, basically. So he's happy to stand down. He's clearly not an ambitious man. So you have this kind of squabble in the palace over who's going to do it. And one of the rival candidates gives Justin, who is commander of the guard, a whole load of gold and says, go out and bribe everyone to support me. So Justin goes out, he's got all this gold, and he thinks, well, I might as well bribe them to support me. And that's what he does.
It's very House of Cards, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very House of Cards. So he becomes emperor, and he has this, he can't read and write, but he has this stencil with the word leggy on it in purple ink. He's the only person allowed to use purple ink. So he can sort of stencil his approval on all these documents. But by this stage, Justin, his name is Flavius Justinus, He is in his mid-60s, is he?
I think 70 even. I mean, he's pretty old.
So the real power behind him is his nephew, who he has
definitely
brought,
is literate.
Yes, who's almost certainly had an education in Constantinople, has come to sort of, you know, to profit from his uncle's success in the guard. And this is the person who calls himself clearly very clever and quite serious, Tom.
He's a very, very devout Christian.
Yeah.
He's also very, very patriotic. He wants to see the Roman Empire restored. He has all kinds of plans. He's impatient with Justin, who, by this point, if Procopius is to be trusted, is slightly losing it.
He's Joe Biden, basically.
He's slightly Joe Biden-ing. Well, no, I think even maybe even worse. But Justinian has big plans, but he obviously needs to. You know, there's nothing guaranteeing the fact that he will succeed. So, you know, he's a bit like a kind of, you know, a prime minister or a president in waiting, like a vice president or Chancellor of the Exchequer or something.
Yeah.
You know, he's running a campaign to make sure that he does it. And as part of that, you know, we mentioned before, he's a keen devotee of the blues in the Hippodrome.
Yeah.
And the blues are, there's a kind of a particular paramilitary wing who all wear mullets.
So I've heard about it. They're Morris and Strange shirts that are very big, but are kind of, they narrow at the end of their arms and their wrists. Weird. Yeah.
So they look, they're kind of like Hephthalites, kind of Hunnic people who are busy attacking the Persians at this point. So they're obviously very menacing. And Justinian employs them as a kind of paramilitary unit to essentially, you know, establish himself as the master of Constantinople while Justin is in the palace. And he's preparing for the rule of the empire. And this is when he meets Theodora. But there's a problem. He falls madly, madly in love with her. And even Procopius, I mean, you know, there's not a breath in Procopius's literary assassination of Justinian Theodora that they were ever anything other than utterly devoted to each other. But there's a problem because she comes from the kind of background that is legally unacceptable.
It's not just infra dig, it's positively illegal. Isn't it? For somebody of senatorial rank, which Justinian is, Justinian was also made consul, I think, in 521. So he's had every office bar the imperial title that you could have, and he just is not allowed to marry her.
And there's a further complication, which is that even though Justin is happy to kind of wangle the law and basically kind of fix it so that if you're a repentant actress, which I think is a wonderful concept,
right,
a repentant actress or prostitute, then you can then the marriage is fine. There's a further complication because Justin's wife, if Procopius is to be trusted, was herself a slave. Had originally been a slave, a concubine. So she was known as, her name originally was Lupicina, and Lupa in Latin means a she-wolf, but it also meant a prostitute. So whether this is just Procopius being muckraking or whether that's true, we don't know. But clearly she came from, again, quite an infradig background. She has taken on, I think, the very telling name of Euphemia, which means well-spoken.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the
very Pygmalion there, Tom.
Yeah, expressive of a certain kind of social anxiety. So basically, the last thing that Euphemia wants is to have this kind of showgirl as a daughter-in-law, because that will then direct attention to her own kind of awkward background. So she dies, fortunately, just in the nick of time. So Justinian and Theodora are able to get married, and then Justin dies, and Justinian is able to become emperor. And Theodora is given a remarkable degree of dignity. I mean, so Augusta, female of Augustus, this is the title of the empress. But Theodora is joined with Justinian in all kinds of salutations and formulae across the emperor. And he makes it absolutely clear that Theodora is going to rule alongside him.
So this is the year 527, the spring of 527, I think the 1st of April. Justinian is in his mid-40s, 45 or so. Theodora is still in her late 20s, about 27 or so. And they now have the reins of power in what is still the Mediterranean's most glittering, most potent, most glamorous and prestigious state, don't they? And Justinian has all these ideas. about how
big
he's going to rebuild the glory of Rome. He's going to change, he's going to transform the map of Europe. And well, Tom, we've been talking for almost 50 minutes. And I think what happens next, which is tremendously exciting, which involves riots, disembodied heads, Persians, plague, every horseman of the apocalypse imaginable.
Cathedrals.
Yeah, building cathedrals. It's tremendously exciting stuff. And I think we should reconvene next time to find out what happens next.
Let's do that.
So let's do that. We shall see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.